top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you on a beautiful Wednesday. Beautiful, at least in the Northeast. Rich Lowry is amongst my guests. Britt Hume is going to kick us off. It's going to be a big show. A lot is happening today, and we'll cover it all. And, of course, Maria Bartiromo had an interview on Fox with the president, second one in 4 days. And here he's going to update us, and we'll have some of those sound bites. He'll update us on where he thinks the war is at. I had a chance to talk to him this morning, the president, and he basically has no voice because he was up yelling at certain people throughout the night, and it wasn't his staff. So before we get to Britt, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
New York City, it is time for a grand experiment once again. During our campaign, we promised New Yorkers that we would create a network of city-owned grocery stores. And we are here today to celebrate the site of the Manhattan store.
Yes.
La Marqueta.
Yes, keep in mind, a Manhattan store that'll be done in 3 years and cost $30 million. This is going to fail. And guess what? It's not even going to be discounted outside some pennies off eggs and milk. It's going to be like any other store. And it's going to fail, I guarantee you. But let's find out together.
Number two.
Some Republicans and others are saying that Democrats turned kind of a blind eye, that they knew what he was up
to
or what the allegations
were. That is absolutely positive.
The rumors I heard were that he was just a flirty social guy. That's it.
Really? Okay. Democrats running for the hills as the scandal plague Washington, D.C. is now overrun. But nobody has it worse than Eric Swalwell, with five separate accusers, already criminal investigations. He's resigning from Congress. What it means for the balance of power and more.
Number one.
I think it's close to over. Yeah, I mean, I view it as very close to over. You know what? If I pulled up stakes right now, it would take them 20 years to rebuild that country. And we're not finished.
That is the president of the United States. Closer to the end than the beginning. That's the indication from President Trump today as he turns up the leverage on Iran with a massive blockade and a freezing of funds, helping with the special help from the Gulf states. Britt Hume joins us now. Britt, not much going on.
Yeah, very quiet news week.
It really is. I mean, let's start with the president. I know that he likes to work the refs and also likes to keep the Iranians off balance. Do you think it's closer to the end than the beginning?
It may well be, but he says that all the time. You know, he's been saying since very early in the proceedings here that it was almost over. And in a military sense, he's had a point. But we're still over there, and we've still got warships active. And he has also said today we're not done yet. So you never quite know with him what exactly is going to happen.
I love the sealing off of the strait. I love the fact that now all countries that were getting, you know, certain countries like China was getting in and out, they're not getting in and out anymore. And the president said that they were making announcements to everyone in the Gulf. Don't even try to come in and out. And that stops, they say, the Iranians from making as much as $430 million each day.
You know, that establishes to me something I've thought all along, which is that the closing of the Strait of Hormuz by Iran was never the great whole card that a lot of people seem to think and that the Iranians seem to think. Simply for this reason, I mean, it was easy for us, once our military was in place and their navy had been destroyed, to impose this blockade. And Iran, of all nations in the world, needs the Strait of Hormuz to be open. And it can't really survive economically if it's closed. And we've closed it without apparently any problems at all.
So I'm amazed. And I remember, and you were working every day but during the Iraq War. And, it, you know, I remember Senator Lugar and some Republicans were not supporting it at the end, and they did not support the surge. I understand it. But I can't believe how many Democrats never or actually seem to be cheering for China. I mean, Chuck Schumer yesterday basically outlining what he says is failure after failure. Senator Warner, who should know better, says there's no reason for this blockade. He can't figure it out. I mean, do you feel this is a change in Washington when it comes to war?
You know, this is driven by one thing, Brian, and it is one of the facts of life of this era, which is that the opposition resistance to Donald Trump, indeed the loathing of Donald Trump among Democrats and their friends in the media, is as intense as anything I've ever seen in politics. It is a very potent force. So no matter what this president does, no matter what, they're going to fight him, resist him, criticize him, oppose him, and find ways to be critical. For someone as seasoned as Senator Warner is to say he doesn't understand the reason for it is ridiculous. But there they all are.
So they say China is affected. They say they're playing a role in this. They said they made 26 calls back and forth between Iran and the U.S. I also think if the president wanted to get a hold of the Gulf states and say, guys, call up China. They want to do business with you. Make China make a decision, us or Iran. They're trying to destroy their energy sector. They're trying to destroy their oil and gas reserves by blowing up desalination plants. It seems the Gulf states understand the danger. Maybe they should let China know because China is their chief supplier. You think that's plausible?
Well, I think China's interesting here because China depends heavily on oil coming out of that region, and oil from Iran in particular. And that shows you that for all the talk about China's 10 feet tall in AI and the threat from China is grave and we're vulnerable and China could do whatever it wants with Taiwan and all that, China has real vulnerabilities. And this is one example of that. And China can't afford to have this go on. It is very much in China's interest to help us to reopen the strait and to get the Iranians to cool it. And I think that's what the president is working on with them. And it's just why I think, and one of the reasons why he had, while he postponed, he did not cancel that summit with Xi, which I think he expects will be a favorable event for him and for the U.S.
I want to give people an example. Somebody you know, Thomas Friedman, he's a deep thinker with big connections, and he has learned to really despise Trump. How do I know? Listen to what he said over the weekend. Cut 15.
I really don't want to see Bibi Netanyahu or Donald Trump politically strengthened by this war because they are two awful human beings. They're both engaged in anti-democratic projects in their own countries. They're both alleged crooks. They are terrible, terrible people doing terrible things to America's standing in the world and Israel's standing in the world. And so I really find myself torn. I want to see Iran militarily defeated, but I do not want to see these two terrible people strengthened.
That is, I saw it think so over the top, I find nauseating. But do you?
Well, I think it's a wonderful example of the force I was just talking about, of the sentiment against Donald Trump. These people, cannot overcome, cannot see past Donald Trump's personal failings as they see them to judge what he has done in any accurate or objective way. I mean, to say that the U.S. standing in the world is being damaged by Donald Trump, oh yes, European leaders are angry at him and a lot of people don't like him personally, but you look at what's been happening around the world, it has not been that the United States is less respected now. I think, particularly militarily, we're probably more respected than we've been in many years.
So I want to talk about what's happened on Capitol Hill. We've seen different scandal cycles, but man, this is a busy one. First on Eric Swalwell. I mean, he's got five different accusers, got investigated. He's being investigated now criminally in Los Angeles and New York City. And then these women that go on the record yesterday, a former model was on there accusing Eric Swalwell of horrific things, including drugging her. And now the question is, who on the Democratic side? And she had the most powerful people, Adam Schiff over in California, had the support of Nancy Pelosi as he's running for governor. Who knew about Eric Swalwell's ways?
I think that it's pretty obvious going back to the time when we all heard about his affair with a Chinese spy. There's something wrong with this guy, that he lacked judgment, that he didn't have good self-control. And for people like Nancy Pelosi to say, as she has been saying for a couple of days now, that she didn't know anything about this, never heard of it, absolutely false, she said. I don't buy that, and I don't think very many people should buy that.
I want you to hear one of the accusers yesterday, Cut 27, Lana Drews.
On the third occasion, I believe he drugged my drink. I only had one glass of wine. He We were supposed to go to a political event, and he said he needed to get paperwork from his hotel room. When I arrived at his hotel room, I was already incapacitated, and I couldn't move my arms or my body. He raped me, and he choked me. And while he was choking me, I lost consciousness. And I thought I died.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking about no longer a governor candidate, no longer a congressman. This guy is heading down the Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein road.
He is, Brian, and he could end up in jail. And you know, this is something that this is a very big scandal, because this guy was a prominent figure and critic of the president. And he was, and the idea that all this was going on with him and nobody knew is really not credible. And, you know, the Republicans didn't really do this. The Democrats looked at the race out in California, and a lot of them thought Swalwell would be their guy to be governor. And suddenly, in that weird primary system they have out there, where you know it's a free for all, it's not done party by party, it's an open primary. Two Republicans were leading, which meant that you could end up with a race between two Republicans in the fall and a Republican governor guaranteed. And the Democrats took one look at that and thought, "My God, we can't have this. We've got to narrow our field. We've got too many candidates splitting the vote and allowing the Republicans to lead." So the next thing you know, they made very swift business of getting rid of Swalwell, aided by this scandal, which broke at a very bad time for him and a very bad time for the Democratic Party.
So you don't think this was an organic thing, or Swalwell's mistakes have caught up with him? You think someone was engineering this, not saying the stories aren't true?
Well, I'm not saying the stories aren't true. I suspect they are true. But the timing was interesting.
Yeah.
And it did, as it happened, his losing his place in the race and then his seat ended up being useful for the Democrats trying to narrow the field in the race for governor.
So this battle between the Pope and the president, it seems like a political battle by a guy from Chicago and a guy from New York, less than it does the president and the Pope. He did take his first shots to the Pope in January, saying that war is coming back in vogue and the zeal for war is now spreading. Made a comment the other day, it's ironic, the name of Donald Trump's website is Truth Social. I'd call that ironic. Says you can never justify war. Called it the madness of war, enough of the idolatry of war. And somebody's self of money, and he goes on to talk about enough of the display of power. So the Pope was taking shots at Trump, and Trump, I think you've heard, doesn't really he returns every shot. What do you think about this?
Well, I think there are people worth fighting with, and people are not worth fighting with. The Pope doesn't have any votes in Congress. The Pope isn't somebody who's a threat to Donald Trump's ability to govern. I don't think it's a smart move to attack the Pope or respond to the Pope with in kind. The things the Pope said were relative. I think you know they're critical, but they're relatively mild. And it's the kind of thing you'd expect clerics to say: opposing the war, you don't want to be militarily aggressive, and all the rest of that sort of thing. We've heard all that kind of thing before. I think Trump, as he does, rose to the bait. I don't think he needed to. I don't think it was wise for him to do so.
I think tactically you're right, but do you find it odd that he would not bring up that President Trump's the only one to take action in Nigeria when Christians were being massacred, including 30 on Palm Sunday? They'll bring up the 1,639 people were executed inside Iran, a high from 1989. They just killed, some say, 41,000 innocent people in cold blood. We've seen the body bags, but yet it's President Trump that gets called out by the Pope?
Well, you know, if he'd said something like that, Brian, you know, if he'd simply cited other examples of that are worthy of criticism by the Pope, that would have been different. But he made it personal.
You mean the way he went back at him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are ways and ways to do these things, and you know, you got the danger that Catholics who revere the Pope will be alienated by this. It'll be to many of them an example of Trump's crudeness and vulgarity and mean spiritedness and all the rest of it. There's no reason to get into that fight.
Media question for you: 60 Minutes Sunday. Norm O'Donnell does an interview with three cardinals and try to get some sound bites from the Pope. Just about, is this a justified war or not? And they picked three, I would never know this, but three liberal cardinals to basically call out Trump. I thought 60 Minutes was trying to be a little bit more fair and balanced. I just thought that was such a, they went out of their way in a different story to be balanced. Why would they go this way?
Well, Barry Weiss, who is now the, you know, the editor at CBS, has a institutional challenge on her hands of trying to turn that ship around and aim it in a more neutral direction. And you know, she's had some successes. Hmm. She's had some controversies. And on this particular one, she probably had a failure.
Brett Hume, thanks for breaking it down for us. Interesting times, Brett. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. All the best.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, just a quick note. Before we have Rich Lowry, I want a little on Brett Hume because he's just a fountain of information and insight. My apologies. But I just do want to remind you, we've got a YouTube channel. So it's you go to YouTube.com. I know everybody's on YouTube. And then you go at the Brian Kilmeade Show. You'll get clips every day, original clips, clips from the show, clips from what I've done throughout. And then we'll have original content in it. Really excited by the start. Hope everyone can get to it. And also, keep in mind, too, you got the Fox News app, where if you have the Fox News app and you want to listen to the show, you're away from your local affiliate, just click on the headsets and you can get it. Also, if you click on the headsets, you could see it because we are now streaming now. Three brand new cameras in our studio and most of our guests will hop on Zoom. So you'll get to see them. So this is a TV and a radio show. So it's audio visual. You'll finally get to see what I look like, which I know is a big mystery. So when we come back, Rich Lowry is going to be with us too. Also, on BrianKilmeade.com, you're going to be able to get tickets to all my local events. I'm going to be coming out to Jacksonville. I'm going to be in St. Louis. I'm going to be in Clearwater. And on May 30th, the next show will be in Reno, Nevada. And then on July 11th, Pensacola, Florida, VIP opportunities where I get a chance to meet you before all the action streamed on Fox Nation. Don't move.
Show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I am deeply sorry to my family, staff, and constituents for mistakes and judgment I've made in my past. I will fight the serious false allegations made against me. However, I must take responsibility and ownership for the mistakes I did make.
That is a clerk reading Eric Swalwell's resignation letter after five separate accusers have come forward and talking about horrific things he's accused of doing. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, joins us now. Rich, the only reason we know Eric Swalwell is because he didn't make his name through innovative legislation, showing great leadership qualities, or doing yeoman's work. He did it by fighting Trump, going after Kavanaugh, doing sensationalistic things, not substantive things, but yet they still, Democratic power base was still behind him to be the next governor. This is a familiar story, isn't it?
Yeah, and we really learned about what he was like, which was an open secret among Democrats, apparently, in California and on Capitol Hill, is because it became inconvenient to the party. That he was in that jungle primary that may have favored Republicans, and they needed to get him out. So all of a sudden, everyone started telling the truth about him, you know, years and years and years too late. And the press likes to take credit. Oh, this is great investigative reporting. No, it's just it was finally convenient for everyone to tell the truth. So, you know, he deserves his day in court. We'll see what his defense is. But at the very least, he's a dirtbag and perhaps a criminal.
But the way the impunity that he thought he had, he thought he was impervious, that nothing could ever happen to him. Listen, yeah. To like, just for people to understand how bad this is. Here's an example of two of his accusers, cut 26.
Ultimately, it reached a point where he invited me to a hotel to meet him. It was very clear what the connotation was. At that point, I completely stopped responding. What I keep thinking back to is how lucky I am that I didn't go to that hotel.
It started out as professional and platonic, and then slowly they became more and more explicit, asking me what I was wearing. Then one night he was on a trip, and he was laying in his hotel room bed, and then he sent me a photo of his penis.
I mean, and the other woman talked about she felt like she was drugged by him. So this is Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby pathway, right?
Yeah, and he had these vulnerabilities, knew he had these vulnerabilities, and decided to run for governor anyway. Goes to the level of impunity he thought he had. And
hey, he ran for president.
Yeah, oh, yeah, exactly. It's easy to forget, right? It ran for president about 2 weeks. Yeah, but he just thought the rules didn't apply to him, and he's one of these guys. Not all congressmen are like this, but a near sociopath who's in it for fame and power and to wield his power in corrupt and cruel ways. So good riddance.
So let's just, there's a Democrat also, McCormick, Sheila McCormick, that took $5 million in COVID money. Even AOC wants her out. And then now Corey Mills, and you have Gonzalez over on the border, in the Texas border area, which is very much a purple area. So he's resigned for ethics reasons. Corey Mills is now being pushed to resign. So this could be 2-2.
Yeah, kind of evens out. Both sides have their very bad apples.
So looking forward, when we talk about legislation, they're talking about a reconciliation bill. Senator Thune's getting pushed to put a lot in there, including elements of the voting rights bill. So where he says, I got to keep this thin, I got to keep it skinny in order to fund the whole DHS. Your thoughts?
Well, it's a process that has rules around it, and if you put stuff in there that doesn't have a direct fiscal effect, the Senate parliamentarian, who I know a lot of people might think, what do we care what the parliamentarian thinks, but he or she does matter in these rulings, will just say you can't do it through reconciliation, and the whole effort will fail. So I know people are very frustrated, but there are just limits to how the Senate can operate. And if we get the DHS funding plus up defense fund spending and a couple other things, I think that's a W, and we should be happy.
Yeah, see if you can get that done and somehow find a way to get people paid. I just think it's a total odd play for Democrats who had a chance to declare victory with reforms that are already in place. I'm sure the president would even have agreed to extending the academy time in ICE to make people feel as though that they're getting additional training. But instead, Democrats just want to make sure ICE isn't funded. So I want to fast forward to the war. Here's the ambassador to the UN, Mike Waltz, cut 5.
The other interesting thing was they brought their central banker. And I don't think President Trump gets enough credit for the second national security policy memorandum he put in place in his second term was to reinstitute maximum pressure. Their economy is in free fall at the UN. We drove snapback sanctions, so the rest of the world has joined us. So time is not on their side here. And as President Trump says, we have the cards, not Iran. We'll see if they come back for a reasonable deal.
The president does think they're coming back, and he had conversations with them yesterday. He thinks we're going to have a second round in Pakistan. Would you like to see the ceasefire extended? Where would you like this to go?
Well, I'd like to see the government collapse. I don't think that's going to happen on the timetable that's convenient to us. I think once you've slaughtered 30,000 of your own people or whatever it is, you're willing to pay any price in the suffering of your own people to maintain yourself in power. So I don't think they're going to collapse because of the blockade. I do think it's more pressure. I think it's pressure towards a deal. I think if you can reopen the strait and they're not tolling it, and I think probably the standard, Brian, is if you can get that highly rich uranium, then I think that's a huge win. I'm not sure that they're going to agree to that. But I think the bare minimum now is reopening the strait. If you can do that and just walk away with the damage you've done to the regime and their military capacity and their missile and nuclear programs, I think that's made us safer.
I don't think so. I think you have to zero enrichment. And with no timeline, you got to get the uranium, and the strait obviously is going to have to be reopened. But I think getting that uranium excavation, pulling it out in a non-war zone setting, I think that's doable. You don't think it's gettable?
You mean to get them to agree?
Yeah.
I don't know. They've just been so committed. They've been so committed to their nuclear program, which is supposed to be just medical research. So we're supposed to believe this theocratic or terroristic regime just really cares about medical research. It'd be a huge win if we can get them to agree and we just go and take it in a peaceful setting. That would be fantastic.
I love the blockade. It was a total reversal. It caught everybody by surprise, especially creative. The Democrats on Sunday, who did not. Senator Warner at one point said, I don't know why he's doing this. I'm really confused. Here's General Jack Keane, cut 12.
Clearly, what we have achieved here is we're shutting down Iran's source of income, period. That is what has taken place before our eyes. That's economic warfare. And what has it given? It's given the administration considerably more leverage going into these negotiations than what they had the first time. That's the reality of what took place.
So this has been a total reversal. It's put all the pressure on them, and now nobody gets in or out.
Yeah, I think it's creative. It flips the script. It's sustainable, right? It's not as though there's zero risk of this, but it's relatively low risk, and you're really squeezing the regime. I mean, it might just flatly run out of money, totally run out of money, and then it'd be very interesting to see where that ball bounces. So I think it's been great, and I've been very disturbed by what Trump said at various points. Now, he may have just been blowing off steam or trying to jawbone the Europeans to help him more. You know, oh, we don't care about the Strait. Our oil doesn't come through there, and let someone else take care of it. No, this is a core aspect of our national security policy going back decades, free navigation of the sea. So we need to reopen the strait, and this is creating pressure to do it.
So Europe, we understand, is preparing for a possible U.S. shift out of NATO. They're accelerating a NATO fallback plan should the U.S. withdraw. Is there a NATO without the U.S., and should they be preparing for something like that?
There's effectively not a NATO. Everything they do militarily really depends on us, logistics and other things, and us to take the lead. There'll still be a European pact, but it won't be nearly as powerful. I think it'd be a mistake to withdraw. I understand why Trump is very annoyed with them at the moment, but I think this is, from the perspective of world history, a huge boon to us to basically have effective control of the defense of Western Europe. There are so many people who, with statesmen over world history, if you told them that they could control Europe and Europe would be happy to be controlled by them, they say, yes, let's do it. And they do add capacities to us. They do have small militaries, but it's additive, and they have other capacities, intelligence, and other things that are helpful to us. So I think it'd be very bad if the lines blew up.
I do, too. And I do think that I love that Orban lost. I also think the president, the only thing I can never agree with him on, is not 100% backing the Ukrainians, who are telling everyone how to innovate and fight. And they're destroying our number one or number two enemy, grinding them to, in a way not many people thought possible. And now they're making 60% of their own weapons, which is pretty amazing, in the middle of a war. But, Rich, absolutely, I want to bring you to the other fight we're having, and that's with the president and the Pope. Here's the president yesterday talking about the Pope.
We don't like like a pope that's going to say that it's okay to have a nuclear weapon. We don't want a pope that says crime is okay in our cities. I don't like it. I'm not a big fan of Pope Leo. He's a very liberal person, and he's a man that doesn't believe in stopping crime. He's a man that doesn't think that we should be toying with a country that wants a nuclear weapon so they can blow up the world. I'm not a fan of Pope Leo.
And the Pope, obviously not a fan of the president, took two shots of him in January, and then said this the other day when he prays for peace.
Holy Father, can I ask you what your hopes are for the Middle East?
I'm praying for peace. I hope that ceasefire would be the most effective way to work together, to find peace for all parties, to respect all parties, and to come to a solution, which is too many years in creating problems for everyone. So
thank you.
Work for peace.
He calls it the madness of war. No cause can justify the shedding of blood. I'm pretty sure the Bible might push back on that. They also went out Trump and said it's kind of ironic that the name of his social media site is Truth Social. I mean, this doesn't sound like a pope.
Yeah. Now, I don't think it's a good look for either of these guys. I don't think Trump needs to be in this feud. And I think Pope Leo, ironically, given his role, is really distorting what the Bible says about warfare. He said that, right, during Palm Sunday, that God doesn't listen to the prayers of people who wage war. What are you talking about? Just look at all the biblical figures from David on who are great warriors, and God listened to them. Did God not listen to Abraham Lincoln or Winston Churchill? Did he not listen to the scared 21-year-old kid in a trench fighting a war that he didn't start? That's crazy. So it's true that we should have just wars. You know, the Catholics believe in just war theory, the very standards you have to meet. I think that they've been met by the Iran war, and it's very irritating that he's talking about peace now, which is great, but where is this very public stand against the Iranians slaughtering their own people? I'm sure he opposed that, but why do you make a big stink about that?
I couldn't find, Rich, you're aware, speaking from the same hymn sheet. I went and looked it up. He said nothing. Between 30 and 41,000 people were killed in cold blood. We could see the body bags. They charged the parents to get for the money, for the bullets they used to kill their loved ones, to get the bodies back. So they just murdered this year. 1,639 people have been executed. Even for the Iranians, that's a high since 1989. And you're talking about a regime that's as ugly as it gets. Now, at what point, how many people, Iranians, have to be killed before the action is just? So I don't get it. Or how big of a nuclear bomb do they need before it's no longer a war of choice?
Yeah. So let's say Trump totally succeeds in this war, and there's a new regime that respects the rights of the Iranian people. Be a huge boon for the Iranians and a huge boon for safety and peace in the region, right? So that's what he's aiming for. So I can understand your Pope, you pray for peace. That's your job description. Do it. I'm very happy about that. But don't portray it as though the Bible opposes absolutely every single war. And don't pretend that there's not a case to be made for this war on the basis of morality alone, let alone the safety and security of the United States of America.
You know, I guess I just was looking it up. Pope Pius XII was Pope during the World War II. At which time, the papers have revealed that they knew about the execution of millions of Jews. They said nothing. They also signed a pact with the Third Reich, basically to protect Catholics in Germany. And are you going to tell me before the Battle of the Bulge, they said the Pope says, well, whoever wins, wins. There's no justifying. So let the Nazis prevail? I mean, are we supposed to assume there's no good and evil in the world?
Yeah, no, it's crazy. And the Bible clearly tells us that evil exists in the world and war is an inevitability, right? A tragic inevitability. But the question in the Bible really isn't between war and peace. It's whether the war is righteous or not and whether it's being waged by a righteous people or not. So that you'd think the Pope, of all people, would understand that.
So, it's just a crazy time. Obviously, the Trump years are a whole different animal, no doubt about it. And for those people who say that Trump's price is in the gas, they're going to make him pay the price at the polls in November. All I say is keep your powder dry. What's happening now is not going to be the case in November. Mm-hmm. And if you're a Democrat, you probably don't want to be talking about gas prices in the fall, because I sense that things are going to get back to normal pretty quickly, because this guy wants to drill everywhere. So the price is going to come down, Rich. So thanks so much. You talk about this in your column. Pope Leo needs to brush up on his Bible. Rich Lowry, thanks so much.
Talk soon.
Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Mr. Chairman and Chancellor-elect Dean, and by the way, I always want to turn around to one guy and say, Barack, what are you doing? Come here. I feel like he should be standing on the right and I should be standing on the left. Hey, you done this look at Barack? Anyway, as I say, you've done good, fella.
Well, you know, I tried.
So that's Syracuse University, where President Biden was caught plagiarizing and finished at the bottom of his class, where he's being honored at the Syracuse Law School, at which point, I guess, I haven't seen the video yet, Allison. Have you seen it? I guess does he look like Barack Obama, or?
I mean, he's a African-American man with a haircut very similar, and he did have a very nice smile.
Okay.
But I mean, yeah.
And so that's just another awkward moment on the stage.
Another example is if like a Republican did that, it would be headlines all over. Can you imagine?
Yeah. So, but as usual, he did, by the way, everything at Syracuse was a lie. He said he went to Syracuse Law School on a sports scholarship. Since when do you go to law school to play sports? Number one. Number two, he said he went on a scholarship. That's a lie, too. And then he said he was at the top of his class. He was at the bottom of his class. And they got caught plagiarizing, which he would later do in the 80s. Where Johnny Carson famously is mocking him because he stole someone's entire speech. That's him. Hey, there's an email that just came in that you were just telling me about.
I did. It is from Natalie, and she said her 14-year-old had a great idea when they were discussing withdrawing from NATO. Basically, he said we should invade Greenland, and then NATO would kick us out, so it would be too problem solved.
Right, because it looks like Trump wants to get out, but he can't. But they could always kick us out. Which would make us happy. I don't think we should leave NATO. I think we should make NATO pull their own weight. Kind of like that. Rich Lowry had a good way to turn that around. He said, look, if you have control over Western Europe and they gave you control, why would you ever give it up? That's another way to look at it.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade coming here from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, where we just found out the good news that in 3 years, we're going to have a city-run grocery store for $30 million. Now, if you don't want to move to New York City yet, now you have a reason. Oh, unless it's a second home, because our governor just said we are going to raise taxes on people who have New York as a second home residence. So are you shaking your head too? Why would anybody decide to get a second home if they know that they're going to be taxed higher when you could have 49 or let's say 30 states that aren't Democratic that will welcome you like Florida or Texas and not punish you for living there? Big three.
Number three.
New York City, it is time for a grand experiment once again. During our campaign, we promised New Yorkers that we would create a network of city-owned grocery stores. And we are here today to celebrate the site of the Manhattan store, La Marqueta.
Yes, La Marqueta. It's an empty warehouse that's going to take 3 years to convert. City-run grocery stores, a bad idea in theory. Now we have it in reality. Exactly what the mayor of New York City is doing with $30 million, I can't tell you. Why this is a socialist project that will fail and we need it to fail, I can tell you that.
Number two.
Some Republicans and others are saying that Democrats turned kind of a blind eye, that they knew what he was up to.
No, that's not true. That is absolutely positive.
The rumors are heard were that he was just a flirty social guy. That's it.
Right. Who drugs his women. Scandal plagued Washington, and no one has it worse and done more bad things or accused of that than Eric Swalwell, now the former congressman. What it means for the balance of power and more.
Number one.
I think it's close to over, yeah. I mean, I view it as very close to over. You know what? If I pulled up stakes right now, it would take them 20 years to rebuild that country, and we're not finished.
That is the President of the United States, closer to the end than the beginning. That's the indication from President Trump today as he turns up the leverage and the heat on Iran with a massive blockade that is very, very effective. It has sealed everything off with 15 ships. And we've already gone through there with minesweepers. Man, you talk about a reversal. So now nobody gets through. You don't get any, and all, anything that Iran has at sea when they're ghost ships or real ships stays. Go sell it. But that's it. They say, on average, $430 million a day they're losing. Now, look, we're paying a price, too. This week, gas is $4.11. Last week was $4.14. Last month was $3.67. We're going to get it down. I thought Brett Stevens had a great column today in the New York Times. He said Trump should put Iran's regime, give him a fundamental choice. It can have an economy, or the regime can attempt to have a nuclear program while trying to control the strait. You can't have both. Iran's central bank has warned their president, Iran's president, that rebuilding the country's war-damaged economy could take more than 10 years. That's the central bank of Iran talking to the president of Iran. Not me, not you, not an American expert, not the IMF. That's Iran to Iran, and we weren't supposed to know that. The bank anticipates up to 2 million in additional people will be left jobless because of the war. Inflation at 180%. It was 40% before the war. They couldn't get water, so they had a riot. Now think about it. 180%. They don't even have a country. As for the effects of the blockade, as I mentioned, 435 million, I was wrong, in daily economic activity is just done. Not only that, helium and the oil and the gas, and the iron that goes through there on a daily basis. I know it's not good to talk about regime change. You can't do it. People don't want to hear it. I understand it. But we have to do something for the people. They got to know if they try to kill their own people again, that we will do something. Personally, I would love that. And Brett writes about that. Israel had an important step. They face-to-face with the Lebanon leader. We went face-to-face with the Iranians, first time in almost 50 years. Because even when they did the JCPOA, do you know that weren't even meeting with them? We had to go through Oman and other intermediaries to do just that. We'd go to Oman, we'd meet with an emissary, back in the Obama days to start setting up a dialogue in order to get them to reduce enrichment. But what Mike Waltz does, who's a key advisor to the president, UN ambassador, he almost said, what the president did over the weekend, and no Democrat will give him credit for it, don't expect it. Ambassador Mike Waltz, cut six.
That's this latest action from the president that says you cannot hold the entire world hostage. You cannot, even though, this Iranian regime started its existence by holding Americans hostage. You can't hold the world's economies hostage. He has flipped the script. You have tremendous naval assets there. And the Central Command just put out its statistics in the sense of it is turning Iranian ships around. Iran doesn't get to choose the winners and losers on the global economy. The United States will do that until all ships are open. So no ships come out or all ships come out.
And by the way, the goal is to put pressure, China, Japan, Russia, not Russia, they're not going to feel any pressure. They just want, if the price goes up, oil, Russia kind of likes it. But now Iran can't sell it, and China needs to buy it. They can't get it. Japan can't get it. South Korea can't get it. So it's got to put pressure on Iran. We're not going to feel the pressure. Look, a dollar a gas is a problem, but it's all temporary, and we're going to get it right back down. And the reason why we know that for sure is not that we have a big checkbook, but we have great production. Victoria Coates, she was a DNI for the president in the first term. Cut 10.
The president's reverse blockade, this idea that it's not Iran
who controls the Strait. It's the United States, is having the intended effect. And what we're seeing from the folks that track the ships around the Gulf, all those ships are heading to non-Iranian ports to take on cargoes. Nobody's going to the Iranian ports. So if the Americans do let up and let anybody out, it's going to be partner and allied ships going to our friends who are going to get those cargoes, not the Iranians. They're not going to get the profits from that.
So this is why it was a great move over the weekend. And I think the enemies of this country, and I think most of them are Democratic, you have all these guys and these women, they're suddenly saying, wait a second, what's going on here? Because they find themselves rooting against the country, against an enemy we universally thought was Iran until President Trump decides to take them on. Do you notice the other thing? For example, the president, everyone knew we should have tough border security. The president gets elected in 2016 being tough on the border. All the Democrats wanted to do was deny him the wall. Now we're getting the wall. 5 miles a day, something like 5 miles a day we're building. We're going to get fill that whole thing up 500 miles. And now all of a sudden with Iran, you have Senator Chuck Schumer, who's desperate to hold on to his job by saying horrible things like this. Cut 12, cut 13.
Let's call Trump's Iran policy for what it is. Not Trump's Operation Epic Fury, Trump's Operation Epic Failure. That's just what it is. It's an epic failure. 45 days into this war, things are worse than the day Trump started his choice of putting us in war.
Okay. What do you say to him? You knew that Iran has been the problem. He's been in Congress the entire time. Now he's in the Senate. Now he's among leadership. What is worse? They are worse. They are beat up. If you want to say that we got to restock our weapons arsenal, I mean, that's something you could worry about, a legitimate worry. We've got to find out a way to mass produce a weaponry and interceptors especially, sure. But to say things are worse, as you see Iran at the table, we're at zero enrichment. They already said we'll give you 5 years of zero enrichment, and we say no. No more enrichment. So good luck with that. We're going to take a timeout shortly because I got Congressman Jim Jordan coming up. But we have a situation in the House right now where we are trying to get funded, the rest of the DHS. They're talking about putting together some type of skinny bill on reconciliation and getting it passed. What's going to be in that bill? We'll discuss it. Also, we're going to discuss the Pope and the president, a battle for it all. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
He just doesn't read the headlines. He breaks them down. Real talk, real news. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Bottom of the hour, we talk a little soccer. The CEO of the New York, New Jersey host committee of the FIFA World Cup coming up before you know it. Starts in June, ends in July. Alex Lasry is going to be with us shortly. And also Congressman Jim Jordan, Chairman Jim Jordan is going to be here. Judiciary Committee Chair and Oversight Committee. He's got a lot on his plate. And people say if they go into minority and Speaker Johnson doesn't want to stick around, he would be the logical replacement. Meanwhile, let's bring in Congressman Jim Jordan now. Congressman, thanks for the time.
You bet, Brian. Good to be with you.
Hey, first off, tell me what you're looking into in terms of Act Blue. This is something that we have found out even independently. They were taking, perhaps the accusation is, taking foreign money to support their left-wing cause and their site?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. And I think it's important to just back up for a second and think, this is the machine that raises the money for the Democratic Party. It's like billions every cycle. Every 2 years, they're raising $3-4 billion that all goes to left-wing Democrats. And so after the 24 election, we started investigating, and we Act Blue let go one of their key members, fired one of their general counsel, and then gave him this special severance package. And four other members of their fraud prevention team resigned as well. So we brought all five of those in for depositions, and we're not allowed to talk about that yet. But I will just say they didn't say a whole lot when we brought them in. And that's on top of the fact that we had documents that show during the 24 election cycle, they lowered their fraud standards and then didn't even follow those. And then, of course, the final one is, we now learned that a letter sent by my colleague, Chairman of the House Administration Committee, Brian Stile, he sent a letter to ActBlue, and their CEO, Ms. Wallace Jones, she responded in a way that her own law firm said, the law firm working for her, said, we don't know if you're exactly representing things in the appropriate way in the letter, in the way you respond to Congress. So that's a big concern, because now ActBlue has actually fired that law firm, and it was Dana Remus who was the lawyer, and she worked in the Biden administration. So it's not like she's some Republican lawyer, for goodness sake. So that's the lay of the land here, and it sure looks like they were taking foreign contributions. We don't know for sure, but that's right. What it appears to be, and we're going to continue our investigation.
As someone who does the investigating, we had Todd Blanche in yesterday, the acting attorney general, and I said to him, these foreign entities that keep funding a lot of these left-wing protests, whether it's pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli, pro-Hamas, or now we have the situation where they're anti-ICE. Why don't we find out who is funding them? He says, when it comes to international funding, it is extremely difficult. Do you back him up on that?
Yeah, it is. And we're looking at some of that same stuff, too, because we think there's money that goes from USAID potentially to these not-for-profits, these NGOs that then's used for all kinds of things. It gets laundered a few times. So we're trying to track that, too. It's not easy, but we're looking at it. But back to the ActBlue, Brian, think about this. Here's the irony of it all. The Democrats, it looks like, were taking foreign contributions, and all we've heard about for the last 10 years is all foreign influence in our election process with President Trump, which was all garbage. But now it looks like it may, in fact, have been them who were doing it. Again, it's one of the things we want to find out if that's actually happening.
I hear the walls are closing on the investigation one way or another with John Brennan, who's sounding off, calling for the 25th Amendment on this president, which is a joke. So your thoughts about the case building on John Brennan, where were you going to go with it?
No, I do think it's there. As you know, last fall, we sent a referral to the Justice Department, a criminal referral on Mr. Brennan, because we know, and we don't do many of these referrals, Brian. We only do it if the facts are there. But if they're there, then we're going to do that. So we referred him to the Justice Department for prosecution because we know without a shadow of a doubt that he lied to us. And he lied to us last Congress when we were deposing him on the 51 former intel letter that he was a part of. But he lied to us about the dossier from clear back 10 years ago. And we know he lied because Tulsi Gabbard and Mr. Ratcliffe last summer declassified and released a report that shows Brennan was the key player in changing the intelligence community assessment clear back in December 2016, January 2017, right before President Trump started his first term. And he used the dossier as a basis to say, to change the intelligence community assessment and say Russia and President Trump were working together, which was all garbage. So, I think it's all part of this conspiracy that the Justice Department is looking into. And the other good news is this is not happening in the Eastern District of Virginia or in the D.C. Circuit or the Southern District of New York. This is taking place in the Southern District of Florida, where I think you're much more likely to get a fair reading of all this and look at all this. So I do think Brennan is I'm hopeful because I think he deserves it. I'm hopeful he's going to be prosecuted.
Chairman, how much harder is your job with gas prices up $1 a gallon?
Yeah, I mean, look, we all know the situation with midterms. It's tough for the party and power in the White House, for their party to keep control of the Congress during the midterms. I think we can overcome that because I think we got a president who has done exactly what he told the American people he was going to do, cut their taxes, secured the border, make sure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon. He's keeping his word, doing what he said he was going to do. And we got to go take that message to the American people. And frankly, I think this is really important. Remind the American people that you know, the Democrats and every position they now take because the left controls their party, every position they take is crazy. Crazy to defund the police, crazy to abolish ICE, crazy to have men compete against women in sports, crazy to shut down the government for 40 some days in the fall and 50 some days here in the spring. I mean, just every position they take, crazy to have sanctuary jurisdictions and all over our country for almost representing almost a third of the population lives in one of these sanctuary cities or states. I mean, all their policies are goofy. So remind the voters, you want to go back to the crazy policies, the open border, everything else? Like Democrats, you want to keep your taxes low and have a secure border and have a Congress and president do what they said they're going to do. Elect Republicans. That'll be a key message, I think, over the next few months.
So Eric Swalwell is now out, although he still gets a pension. Are you one of those caught by surprise by his personal life?
I mean, look, I always say these situations, obviously this sounds very serious, and you feel for the victims here, of course. But I always say these situations, ethics committee should handle this stuff. And this is a question between the member and their constituents, their voters. And I always think that's the better way to do it instead of having Congress do all the things that they, you know, we sometimes try to do here. So it looks like that's exactly what's happened here, both with him and and Representative Gonzalez. Their voters have, I think, spoken, and they've recognized what their voters are saying, and that's why they took the actions that they took yesterday.
And where's the investigation with Corey Mills? Is he gotten through the other side, or?
Well, that's in front of the Ethics Committee. There's also the other member from Florida, and her investigation has already been through the Ethics Committee. They're going to, I think, issue a final recommendation next week. So I think that's the right way to do it. The Ethics Committee is equal, you know, Republicans right. and Democrats. They look at this stuff. They make a decision after gathering all the facts and doing the kind of due diligence and process that you would, I think you would want a committee to do.
All right, Chairman, thanks so much for the quality time.
I appreciate it.
I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
All right, when we come back, we talk a little World Cup soccer with Alex Lazary. Yeah, you're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. And keep in mind, too, there's a way to follow the show if you can't hear us live. We've got a YouTube page. Go to youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadeShow. Also, if you want to listen live, you go to the Fox News Radio app and you just click on the headsets. And now, because people like Jim Jordan find a way to the Zoom, you could actually see the show as well as hear the show, of course, unless you're driving. And when they ask you if you are driving, you got to be honest and say you are driving. Don't say you're not driving, because then you'll end up looking at this and I'll feel responsible.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's going to be an event like you've never seen before. I know people know about Super Bowl week and there's build up, and I get it. But how about a tournament that lasts weeks upon weeks and goes through the beginning of the summer, June and July? And in the middle of it, we're celebrating our 250th birthday. Of course, I'm talking about the World Cup, and it's coming, and America has got a good team. I think we're 14 in the world right now. Alex Lazary is running things in the New York, New Jersey area. He's running the stadium at MetLife, which is where the finals are going to be. Alex joins us in studio now. Great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when you got this job, did you know it was going to be this engrossing, this encompassing?
You always have a sense of what something like this is going to be. This is going to be the biggest sporting event that the world has ever seen. So you know that this is going to be very time consuming and full time, but you can never put into perspective or think about like what this is going to be leading up to it. It just kind of takes on a life of its own.
What did you learn from watching the club championships here?
I think we got a really good sense of just how to work with FIFA. Getting a good rapport for how FIFA and the agencies and everyone needs to work together. But at the end of the day, while club was great and I think a huge success, the scale and scope of it is nowhere near what the World Cup is going to be. Club was similar to putting on a Taylor Swift show, which is massive and enormous. But the World Cup is just, its scale and scope of it is just that much larger.
And for New York, New Jersey, it's not only got the final, but how many games are you going to have here?
So we've got 8 games total. We're expecting millions of people to be coming here, over $3 billion of economic impact. You know, to put into perspective what the final is going to be like. The last World Cup final was viewed by the same amount of people as the last 13 Super Bowls combined.
Wow.
So this is the world sport. This is going to be the largest sports entertainment event in human history. And we get to have it right here in New York, New Jersey.
But yet it's turf. What are you going to do about that?
So we are actually growing grass in Tuckahoe Farms, New Jersey.
That's a big area for the club soccer.
So we are going to be bringing in grass from Tuckahoe, New Jersey, into MetLife Stadium. It should be coming in the next few weeks, and then it'll be ready for the
World Cup. Are you laying it on top of the turf, or is it tiles? Is it going to be like a puzzle piece?
No, they'll be laying it on top of. So they've kind of taken the turf out. We put a little ground something on top.
Oh, the turf will be taken out.
So they'll be putting the grass on top of. They've put some stuff down to help make sure that the turf is going to be able to be implanted and kept.
What group is here?
So we've got, so are the teams that we have. I can't remember the group, the specific group letters, but we've got Brazil, Morocco, that's going to be kicking off. Then France, Senegal, Senegal, Norway, Ecuador, Germany, and then England, Panama. So the biggest teams on the biggest stage are going to be coming right here.
And then you're going to get to the knockout round.
So then we've got a round of 32, a round of 16, and then we'll have 2 weeks to prepare for the final on July 19th.
And why do you think New York got it? Because it's New York City? Is it something about MetLife? What do you...
I think both. I think, like, look, we're the capital of the world. And so if you're looking to have the biggest stars on the biggest stage, you're going to do it right here. MetLife Stadium, one of the biggest stadiums in the world. It's seen everything. I think the transportation network, you know, being able to get people to the game is one of the most intricate. So I think that is why. So I think you kind of look at everything. Mm-hmm. It just makes sense. And I think if you talk to anyone around the world, where should the world, like if you're doing the World Cup in the U.S., where would the final be? I think everyone would say New York.
So, Alex, the one thing I would say is that I was at the Super Bowl in New York, which, by the way, don't do in a cold climate, but it's not my decision. But they could not, when the game ended, the train showed up, and people must have been there for hours to form them. You could not get on the trains. Did we make any adjustments to that? Because this is going to be bigger.
The scars from the Super Bowl is probably the thing that I've heard the most. I was also at that game. The lessons learned from that, and again, that was, you know, 12 years ago. So everything has kind of changed. I think what we're really focused on right now is how do you fix the egress, right? Ingress, you're going to have, you know, 3-4 hours to get to the game. A lot of excitement and everything going on. After the game is obviously going to be, is everyone's trying to leave.
At the same time.
I think a number of differences from the Super Bowl. One, the Super Bowl ends at like midnight. So everyone just wants to get home right away. The World Cup's going to end around 6 o'clock. So the fan village is going to be open. The teams are still going to be celebrating everyone, the trophy ceremony. So I think that'll help the egress and you won't have everyone kind of rushing to the train. We're announcing the mobility plan on Friday, but we will have also a bus network that'll be there. We're going to have rideshare. So I think we've learned a lot of lessons, and I think we are all ready and prepared for what this is going to be.
So raising headlines today in that MetLife, it's no reflection on you, but New Jersey Transit is going to be charging $100 for round-trip tickets. That's up 775% from what the average person usually pays.
So from my understanding, the price hasn't been finalized yet, and that'll all be revealed on Friday. But what I can say is, you know, for these events, you know, there's a lot of extra costs that get put on to ensure that these things can run smoothly. And I think, you know, the governor is making a decision that this isn't going to be just be borne by the taxpayers of New Jersey. We have written letters and asked, you know, the federal government for help on these costs. I think, you know, a few months ago we wrote one asking for, you know, a little over $400 million across all the host cities.
You want the federal government to pay $400 million?
The Fed stepped up. No. Across all the host cities, similar to the security funding, Fed stepped up and did $100 million, which was incredible and helpful, and is going to be a big boost in making sure that our transportation network is going to be sufficient to bring people to the final. But these things are big events. This is the cost of having this. And I think, you know, when we reveal the mobility plan on Friday, I think everyone's going to be really excited about kind of all the options that we're going to have to get people to the stadium.
So are all the venues sold out?
I can't speak to all the other venues. I can tell for ours, the demand for it is through the roof. All the tickets haven't been released yet, but we've had no issue and I've seen no issue, on sales, and demand has been through the roof.
So the one thing too, could you go into the ticket prices? Because one of the big controversies is how much it does cost. So 94 World Cup is considered the most successful World Cup ever. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about that and compare the two. But what could you tell us about the ticket prices?
So FIFA sets the ticket pricing, and I think what we've seen, you know, I think what they would say from demand is that, you know, the market kind of speaks, and people, they've had, you know, especially for our region, I think our region is the top demand for tickets, because, you know, you just kind of look at the teams that are here. I think then what the host committee is trying to do is also make sure that we're providing affordable and accessible spaces to participate in the World Cup. So when you talk about the fan engagement places that we've announced, so the Jersey Fan Hub at Sports Illustrated, are the event that we're doing at the U.S. Tennis Center, watch parties at Rock Center.
Well, by the way, you want to expand on that, by the way? Can you tell us about what you just said? You're doing...
Yeah, so we're going to be throwing, you know, kind of official New York, New Jersey FIFA fan festivals all across the region. So we've got the Jersey Fan Hub at Sports Illustrated for select dates that we'll be announcing in the coming weeks, where you'll be able to go and watch the games and participate in the World Cup experience. Same thing at the U.S. Tennis Center, same thing at Rock Center. So the Tennis Center will be during the group stage, and Rock Center from July 5th to July 19th.
So interesting. It's a city decision. We don't want large groups. Maybe you can help me with this. They don't want large groups getting together. Are they worried about that? Because when the ball drops on July 4th to announce our 250th birthday, they were saying, well, World Cup rules say we can't have large groups getting together. So there won't be that Times Square feeling when the ball drops for July 4th, commemorating our birthday. What is the city rules for large gatherings?
So for us, we've been working with the city to make sure that we're able to put on successful spaces and affordable and accessible areas for World Cup watch parties, right? This is stuff that we've been working with FIFA on, the city, the state, and state of New Jersey to provide these spaces. The Tennis Center should be around, you know, 10,000 people. Rock Center, obviously, Rock Center, people will be able to walk freely around.
Right, where the tree was?
Yep.
The tree is?
Yep. Okay. We'll have some screens right there. We announced the Rock Center in, I believe it was November or December of last year, for the Fan Village with Telemundo. It's going to be really exciting and fun, and this is a way for fans from all over the world to participate and be part of the World Cup, whether you're going to the game or not.
Alex Lazary's in studio, CEO of the New York, New Jersey host committee for the FIFA World Cup, which is getting here faster than you know it. This is what I feel. So I grew up playing soccer since I was five. So everyone would say, why are you playing? You know, in the beginning, like, why are you playing that sport? But once you start playing, you become like your own community, but it was a niche sport. Then people that liked the World Cup played soccer. Okay, got it. Now, for the first time in my lifetime, I have non-soccer players, American.
Yep.
Obviously, around the world, they don't know what I'm talking about. Non-soccer players interested in this, like non-baseball players interested in baseball. Have you noticed it?
Yes. I actually think the Premier League being shown now on NBC and being so much more available in the U.S., same thing with UEFA and kind of all of the global, you know, football around the world. I think that's led to even more excitement and knowledge about the game. And I think my hope for this World Cup is that this World Cup will do what the Dream Team did for basketball around the world. Right. The Dream Team directly led to Giannis, Jokic, Dirk, et cetera. This World Cup having Mbappe, you know, Lamine Yamal, Pulisic, Ronaldo, Messi playing on our shores in competitive games, not friendlies, competitive games, hopefully will lead the next generation of U.S. athletes to say, I want to go play for on this stage and I want to help lift the trophy for the U.S.
So let me tell you, because I would anything I could do to promote soccer, I think is a positive. But the best thing that could happen is for the men to be as dominant as the women.
Mm-hmm.
We're 14 in the world. Lost 5-2 to Belgium. I think 2-1 against 2 days later. I forgot who they just lost to in Atlanta. But and I understand they're still formulating the roster and 9 subs in the game. But you got to be somewhat let down over the last two performances, because if you can't compete with Belgium, that's a problem.
Belgium's one of the top teams in the world.
But if you want to be one of the top teams, you can't lose 5-2.
And I think, when you kind of look at where the U.S. is, I think, you know, we've got some of our top players playing around the world in some
first
of the top leagues.
Ever.
I know. We've got our players playing in, like, the top leagues, and this is kind of what the growth is. I mean, we've never gone past the first, you know, we've...
I don't think we got to the quarters, did we?
No, I think we've gotten, you know, past the first round once. And this is kind
South
of...
Korea.
Yeah, and this is kind of the next stage for the U.S. men's national team, is to now... Now we've got, I think, the talent. It's now we've got to put it together on the field and show that we can compete. And again, my hope, look, you saw what the 99 World Cup did, I think, for the women's national team. The images of that game.
I was actually at that game, 101,000.
Yeah, the images of that game led to probably the next generation of women's athletes all saying, I want to play soccer. And it's why the women's national team is one of the most dominant national teams ever in like sports history. Hopefully this World Cup, seeing some of the greatest players around the world, feeling the excitement of what the World Cup is, right? Going to these watch parties and just being a part of everything that something like this can do, right? Like, you know, as a kid, what kind of effect that can have on you and what you want, what sport you want to play. Hopefully this taking center stage, especially here, will lead kids to wanting to say, instead of playing basketball and football, right, I want to go play football.
Right, exactly. And one of the things they did for us in our area is watching the Cosmos, mm-hmm, and Pele and Canalia and Beckenbauer and Carlos Alberto and all these guys. And you said in the middle of that's an American goalkeeper and Ricky Davis, an American player. So you have the American and the image and what it's like and the best players in 54,000 on a Wednesday, 77,000 on a Saturday. To me, it was totally logical. In fact, Howard Cosell, in his book, said, I guarantee one thing, the soccer is the next great game, the next major sport. It dipped, NASL folded, and now the MLS is here with 30-plus teams at values that are in the millions.
Valuations are skyrocketing. You've got the new NYCFC stadium that's going to be opening in 2027.
Right next to Citi Field.
Yeah, right next to Citi Field. That's going to hopefully, I mean, you're almost building a kind of a nice little sports park right in Queens, right, which is going to, you know, kind of become like a center of sports for in New York. But I think, you know, Etihad Stadium kind of opening is also going to lead to more ways to participate and be a part of soccer. And right, I think more access to being able to watch the top players and the top leagues in the world has been incredible for the growth of the game here. We now just have to take our team to the next level. And, you know, look, we can have all the warmups we want. It's all going to be about what happens on the biggest stage, you know, come June, and hopefully our team is able to do it.
What's your and your family's background in sports?
So, I mean, I grew up obviously playing a bunch of, you know, I played a lot of basketball and tennis growing up. Got into, you know, golf as my athleticism, the little athleticism I had waned. Our family used to own the Milwaukee Bucks. So I'd been living in Milwaukee for 10, 12 years, helping run the team. Had a great time, won a championship. And then this opportunity came up. My dad currently is now, after we sold, he's running a sports fund. So a lot of investments in sports. So this has kind of become like a real center of our life.
So what, doing that with the Bucks, how'd that set you up for here?
I think getting a sense of how, like, look, this is sports and entertainment at the end of the day. So how do you know, how are you selling to sponsors? What type of things are fans looking for? And how are you engaging and creating experiences and authentic experiences that fans want? And I think that's a lot of what we have to do. Knowing what, you know, our partners are looking for and how we can activate and make sure that they're getting what they need, because these things do have to be paid for. And you do need to make sure that the partners that you have feel like they're getting the value that will then also lead to partners wanting to be a part of the next big event that we're doing, right? You don't want them to feel like they were dissatisfied from working on this one. So I think the 10 years that, you know, the 10, 11 plus years that I had at the Bucks, you know, really helped me kind of get a sense of how the world works, what we can do, but nothing really prepares you for something like this.
I know, and Alan Rothenberg was in, he wrote the book, and he brought in the 94 World Cup here, and that was a big success. Do you think this will be bigger?
I do. Sports and entertainment right now is so much larger than it was in 94. Just media rights, the fandom. This is going to be the largest World Cup, right? 48 teams now. So I think this World Cup has the chance to be, again, the biggest sporting event that human history has ever seen. We have a big responsibility to put on an experience that is worthy of New York and New Jersey. And I think we're on path to be able to do that.
And they picked the right guy to pull it off. Alex Lazary, CEO of the New York, New Jersey host committee for the FIFA World Cup, which is going to be here before you know it. Thanks so much, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Back in a moment.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
That is the change that government can deliver. And it is the change that democratic socialism can deliver. I know there are many who use socialist as a dirty word, something to be ashamed of. They can try all they want, but we will not be ashamed of using government to fight for the many, not simply the few.
I think that's one of the scariest series of statements that I could hear. Because that is the cheering of socialism. The elected mayor of the top city in the most famous city in the world, people could say top, that's up for your personal opinion, certainly biggest, And then you have the mayor of that city say it's about socialism. He's happy. And that should be stunning. If you're in a debate stage and someone says you're a socialist, that's usually an attack line. Now, for the first time, if you're not Bernie Sanders, people are welcoming it. I mean, AOC and the Quad, they don't say I'm socialist. Even though listen to what they stand for. Now you have a guy saying I'm socialist. And he turns around and says, for $30 million, yes, you could have a grocery store. And people cheer. I mean, this is so backwards. I hope we see an epic fail. And then we understand the theory behind capitalism. And we'll be forced to define it instead of taking it for granted.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a lot happening. 1-866-408-7669. Carl Rove is standing by. Don't want to keep him waiting too long. Martha McCallum right after that. Keep in mind, guys, we got a YouTube channel now. Everybody's talking about it. Everyone's got to have it. Almost as much as the Trump Watch. YouTube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadeShow. Do you think people want to see me on YouTube more than people want a Trump Watch? Allison, do you know?
I mean, 100%.
Right, because everyone's talking about it.
Everyone, and no one can get enough of you.
I know, that's true. I know that the Trump Bibles, he doesn't talk about the Bible, but he still talks about the watches. I always see those ads.
He still talk about the sneakers? Or I haven't heard sneakers in a while.
No, I think they're out. I think when he said limited edition, I think he actually meant it.
He meant it, okay.
Everyone says limited edition, but they don't really mean it. I think he actually means it. So it's too late. They probably don't have your size. So listen, I'm going to be talking about the ridiculous $30 million grocery stores. I'm going to be talking about the scandals in Washington, and I'm also going to be talking about the war in Iran. But first, let's bring in Karl Rove, former deputy chief of staff, service advisor to President George W. Bush, Fox News contributor. Karl, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Karl, I mean, even for you and everything you've experienced in Washington, do you ever remember a situation where we're looking at a Democratic congresswoman, $5 million of COVID aid, ethics committee investigates, guilty? And then we have a situation with the congressman from Texas, who I always enjoyed interviewing him, made a bad personal decision, tragedy, the woman he allegedly had an affair with kills herself, so he is resigning. And then Eric Swalwell, somebody who made his living going after Trump, now has five separate women and criminal investigations in Los Angeles and New York City. That's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, my column tomorrow for the Wall Street Journal is about this very subject. It starts with Swalwell, who, you know, was not a serious legislator. This guy was a performance artist masquerading as a legislator. And all he cared about was getting more clicks and more, you know, MSNBC, MS Now interviews and repeats of his repostings of his various sundry social media items. He was a terrible human being. And he started this off and by, you know, first withdrawing from the governor's race in California. Good for him. You know, that was going nowhere. Even though he was leading with 12, you know, leading the Democratic field with 12%, it wasn't going to go any further. And then he resigned. And then it, that gave Tony Gonzalez a chance to sort of get in the slipstream and resign as well. I got to tell you, that hurts me enormously. I knew him. He was my friend. We hosted him. I'm sitting here in my home. We hosted fundraisers for him here. I asked friends to contribute to him. He was a serious legislator. It was a great American story. You know, grew up in modest circumstances, joins the Navy, becomes a chief petty officer, gets made a congressional fellow, a Navy congressional fellow assigned to the office of Senator Marco Rubio. Father of six, goes home to West Texas, runs for Congress in a swing district and wins. And the district is bigger than 26 states. It's bigger than the state of Pennsylvania, the district is. And he did a wonderful job, and he was a serious legislator, and he was on appropriations and homeland security and worked hard to secure the border. And not only that, but to fix a broken immigration system. But the demons inside him caused him to do bad things, and he's gone now. And good riddance. But we're at a moment where trust in government and trust in our leaders is so low. We don't need more. We don't need more examples like the gal from Florida who's stealing money from taxpayers in order to fund her campaign for Congress. You know, that's just pathetic. And you know, the Democrat leadership is now saying, well, we need to let the process move forward. Okay, fine. But she needs to be gone. And we need leaders today who will inspire us, who will stand up in the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and make us proud of our country and proud of our leaders.
So I know it's the least important thing about this story, but just going back to the politics of it, because it's going to go to the November election, there's going to be a special election and a November election. That's a tough district for Republicans to win, isn't it? That's not a layup.
Yeah, and particularly since we have a guy from New Jersey who moved down to the district, who's you know, who has videos of him, you know, displaying his latest gun acquisition, which is a German World War II submachine gun. And I mean, he's not a serious guy, and the Democrats fortunately don't have their most serious candidate put up. But there's a good likelihood that the Republicans will either lose the district or win it by having to spend an enormous amount of money. That could be spent well elsewhere. And it's a tough district. It runs from San Antonio to El Paso. And I'm serious, 26 states are smaller in area than the 58,000 square miles of the 23rd Congressional District. And we got a guy from New Jersey, not a guy who grew up in that part of the world and had friendships and alliances throughout the district. We got a guy who's a transplant.
So I want you to hear what I think is one of the scariest statements, which I think is going to become part of what we're used to now. And it is the mayor of New York City, proudly, after 100 days, saying what he is. Cut 38.
That is the change that government can deliver. And it is the change that democratic socialism can deliver. I know there are many who use socialist as a dirty word, something to be ashamed of. They can try all they want. But we will not be ashamed of using government to fight for the many, not simply the few.
Proud to be a socialist. The crowd roars afterwards. That used to be a dirty word that a Democrat told a Democrat, a Republican went after a Democrat with. But now they're embracing it. Are we going to have to get used to this? Is this not jarring to you to hear that? And will at one point this not be jarring?
Yeah, of course it's jarring, but I welcome it. They're out in the open. They're admitting it. And let them live up to the consequences of their actions. You know, Apollo, one of the big financial institutions in New York, is leaving, going to Florida or Texas, and taking with it thousands of jobs and enormous amounts of income that is now going to be not taxed by the city of New York and the state of New York, but they're going to two states with no state income tax. And as a result, really bright, smart people who are capable of doing great things are leaving the metropolitan area of New York. And this nutty idea that he has of a $30 million grocery store that is going to be located in a neighborhood that is within 7/10 of a mile of, what is it, 5 or 6 other grocery stores. He's got a Costco that's within seven tenths of a mile, a 15-minute walk. And this guy is going to take taxpayer money and, you know, and create this thing which doesn't have to pay taxes like all the other private businesses around it. And we'll see how long this experiment lasts. And remember, he doesn't want just one such store for New York. He wants hundreds of these things throughout New York. Just do the math. $30 million to create a new grocery store.
It's crazy.
I mean, you know, crazy, nutty, insane. And the Democrats across the country are going to have to say whether they're with him on the, not only these nutty ideas of his, but these statements of he and his wife excoriating the state of Israel and welcoming terrorists into the into the mayor's mansion. I mean, how disgusting is that? This is a city that was struck by Islamic terrorists on 9/11, and this guy is parading around, and his wife is writing positive postings about a guy who welcomed October 7th, the slaughter of innocents in Israel.
100%, and I will say a couple of things are happening. $30 million to open up a grocery store that will take 3 years. Can you imagine this? 3 years to open up a grocery store. You definitely don't understand capitalism and understand a deadline. And they're making it clear the prices of goods might not be that much cheaper. And then people are telling me they might have to use a union. So they might have to hire unions. Those wages are not going to be cheaper. So what is going to be the benefit? To have it look drab like the motor vehicle or look like the post office? I mean, that's going to be the advantage.
Well, the advantage is that it puts more power in the hands of the government. It puts more power in the hands of the mayor. It puts more hands in more power in the hands of the city council, not more right. power in the hands of the people. Look, HEB or Randall's or you name it can build a grocery store faster than 3 years, and it ain't going to cost $30 million.
And they build their own building. They're even taking over a building. Carl, I don't want to talk too much about New York, but I do want to say this. The governor of New York, looking for revenue, has decided to raise taxes on people who have homes here as a second home worth more than $5 million. If you're going to leave it vacant, you should pay more. If there's anybody, if there is so much wrong with that statement, they're telling people who have a second home here, we will punish you. So guess what those people are going to say? I will not have a second home here. What is wrong right. with these people?
Well, obviously, she's, you know, she's not a self-proclaimed democratic socialist. She's just a misguided liberal. I mean, talk about pathetic. This is the Empire State. We're talking about the fourth largest state in the union by population and probably the second or, you know, third by wealth. And yet it has been badly mismanaged under her leadership and, frankly, the leadership of her predecessor. The last good governor the state had was George Pataki, in my opinion, and he was sitting there fighting the gate, you know, fighting. The people were coming over the walls trying to tax more and spend more and regulate more, and he was doing his best to keep that from happening. But she is clueless. I am glad that she is the governor of New York, because the businesses that she is driving out of the state, many of them are going to relocate in Texas.
So Bruce Blakeman, as you know, has done a fantastic job in Nassau County, welcoming ICE, welcoming the cops. The law enforcement's the number one of the country, and he wants to be the next governor. You know, he's got plenty of experience. He understands New York. What advice would you have for Bruce if he wants to win, which he does?
Yeah, well, look, I think he's doing it. I mean, you know, do what he did in Nassau County, which is hold the line on the spending, look out for the taxpayer, economize in government, reform. Think about doing new things in a more efficient, better way, or leaving them up to the people to do. And he ought to starkly compare an agenda of progress for the state of New York with Hochul's agenda, where she wants to raise taxes, he wants to cut taxes. When she wants to regulate more, he wants to regulate less. And have a positive agenda that's going to make a difference in the lives of people of New York. Because, look, people are voting with their feet. Poor New York is losing people. I mean, a lot of them heading to Florida, a lot of them heading to Texas, a lot of them heading outside the state to more reasonable tax environments and business environments. And that can't go on forever without the state of New York suffering mightily. You spend twice as much money per capita as the state of Florida, the government of the state of Florida spends per capita. And there's a message there.
Right. So now we know it's going to be happening. Democrats are going to be running that the wealthy are not paying enough. Yesterday, Cory Booker and Chris Van Hollen, both with presidential aspirations, in my view, say they're advocating to raise taxes on high earners. Let me just share this with you, which you know, for people at home, for those people who think the rich aren't paying enough, the top 1% pay 40% of all income taxes. The top 10% pay 72% of all income taxes. The top 25% pay 87% of all income taxes. That's federal, let alone what they do in the state. What are they talking about? I mean, this is what they're going to run on. Now, statistically, are they smart by this, doing this? Because 75% are not part of the top 25%, obviously.
Yeah, maybe they're politically smart, but it's assuming people are dumb. And they're not dumb, and they ultimately figure things out and try to do the right thing. Are you sitting down? I can see you that you're sitting down. But
yes,
I want to make certain that you're and you're lean back in your chair, because I don't want you to fall over when I say this. Do you know who wrote an editorial yesterday saying the income tax system in America is truly progressive? The Washington Post editorial board. And it said many of the same numbers that you were talking about. They spelled out how they said, look, everybody keeps talking about making it more progressive, but we have one of the most progressive tax structures in the world, because a small group of people are paying the bulk of the tax burden. That is, incidentally, not a recipe for success. Everybody ought to have a little skin in the game called America. And if we keep passing the burden onto the people at the top, the you know, the people who have been successful and have created industry and created business and invented things and helped bring about prosperity for all Americans, we're going to start driving those people abroad.
Right,
and we're going to stop. We're going to have people saying, you know what, it's not worth it for me to work harder and work smarter. I got enough. Let me move to France and live a lovely life. Let me move to someplace in the Caribbean. We are a great country because we encourage and enterprise and entrepreneurship and compassion and creativity. And doing what we were doing in New York is proven that if you do too much of that, if you do too much taxes and regulation and red tape, you'll drive people to more hospitable climes. And in that instance, they can go to another state. But if you do it nationwide, we're going to be driving them to other countries.
All right. So let me drill down. Scott Bessent used to come on the show before he got this prestigious job. And he said, what do you want to focus on most? You know what he said? Income inequality. He said, I'm worried about the distance between the wealthy and the working class. He says, I think it's getting too great. So recognizing that, what would your answer be? I know you're not an economist, but you know this stuff.
Yeah, look, my answer would be to help people move up the ladder. For example, we ought to have more technical training. We're doing a renovation. We've got some people who are skilled electricians working on the house. They make a good living. And you know what they tell me? There are not enough of us. These companies that employ electricians and welders, we have a ranch. We sponsored our ranch foreman's grandson to go to welding school. The kid is 19, about ready to turn 20 years old. He is graduating from Texas State Technical College as a master welder, and he is being offered, he has no debt, and he is being offered jobs about $100,000 a year to start.
Amazing.
And he's 20 years old, high school graduate, who went to a technical school.
Gotcha.
We ought to be focused on what can we do as a country, as a state, and as a society to help people move up the ladder of prosperity by giving them skills to succeed.
I thought I booked Karl Rove. I got Mike Rowe. Who knew? Karl, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, buddy. All the best.
Hey, Martha McCallum's coming in. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Mr. Chairman and Chancellor-elect Dean. And by the way, I always want to turn around one guy and say, Barack, what are you doing? Come here. I feel like he should be standing on the right and I should be standing on the left. Hey, did you just look at Barack? Anyway, as I say, you've done good, fella.
Well, I try.
So the former president was at Syracuse University getting some type of honor where he was at the bottom of his class and actually got caught plagiarizing. But they forgot about that. Martha McCallum in studio with Stowe. Show starts at 3:00. We just have a minute there. Kind of interesting. He noticed that there was another person on stage.
I didn't see this video, so I'm not sure what was happening, honestly.
Did you see it, Allison? You saw it, right? So do you think the person looked like Barack Obama?
Yeah, so Biden was on stage and he called up the trustee behind him because he sort of resembled Barack Obama. He's an African-American man with similar haircut and a nice smile. But that was sort of it.
Wow. Okay.
That's Joe Biden being Joe Biden.
That sure is. That sure is. God love you.
God love you. What am I talking about?
What am I talking about?
So, listen, more and more to McCallum in a moment. It's hard to explain, but you got to be seen. It's tough on radio, but you'll have a chance to see it and make your own judgment. Remember, he said you could not go to a 7-Eleven without seeing somebody
with an Indian accent.
All right, don't move. When we come back, we talk about Iran. A lot going on.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. Martha McCallum's here, set to host her show at 3:00. Before we get all caught up, and there's so much to talk about, Martha, do you know who you're focusing on yet?
Well, John Thune's going to be on today, so we're going to spend a fair amount of time with him as we talk about a number of things. I mean, people, I feel like people forgot that DHS still isn't funded. They're still working on that. As soon as the president started cutting checks to TSA, it was like everybody forgot about the story. So that is one of the things we're going to touch on with him. We're also going to talk about the war, because basically Democrats in the Senate are doing a weekly vote to shut the president's ability to orchestrate the war down. So that's also happening today. So we have a lot of things to talk to him. There's also some new Cook polling that shows that Cook has, and they're, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, they watch like all the Senate races and the House races way in advance to sort of get a sense for where they're going. And they've shifted like one step to the left for four Senate races. So if it was like a Republican in Nebraska, they're now saying likely Republican. So it's a little worrisome for Republicans who have a 4-seat advantage right now, and you've got four states that are looking like they might be shifting a little bit. So we're going to talk to him about that as well.
I will say, just breaking down this, that's great. And by the way, he's one of the great people.
He's great.
When you think about somebody that want, I don't care if it was a Democrat or Republican, that you want legislating, no ego. Just wants to get things done.
Yes.
Doesn't want to be on camera.
Yes.
But he needs to be on camera, because you need a voice out there.
No, he's a good, has integrity.
Just breaking down the Senate a little bit, I think what people underappreciate, I think Sununu's got a real shot in New Hampshire.
Could be.
And I also think Rogers got a legitimate shot in Michigan.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, he lost by a half a point. It reminds me very much of McCormick.
Yes.
Who didn't get out of the primary. He lost to Oz by just 10,000 or 20,000 votes.
Exactly.
In the general.
No, I think that's a good model. And I think that, it is a very good state to watch. I know that Rogers has been concerned about the impact of the war. He thinks it's not, you know, in terms of gas prices in Michigan, he's a little bit concerned about that. He wants to see the president focus back on the U.S. economy. So we'll see how that goes. You got to watch Elise as well, because she's considering running for president, I think, from Michigan as well. Elise Stotnick.
No question.
Yeah.
The question is, who would Whitmer run?
Mm.
And it seems like people want her to run more than she does.
Yeah, it does seem like that, doesn't it? We'll see.
Yeah, and the other thing would be...
It could be crowded Democrat primary. Ro Khanna pictures himself up there. The only one who might have thought about running is Eric Swalwell, but now he's not running for anything.
Yeah, oh my goodness. He's going to be running to try to stay out of prison.
Exactly.
So just before we leave the Senate, the place for Democrats to best flip would be probably North Carolina. Watley's got the machine, the knowledge, but Cooper seems to resonate with the people in North Carolina.
Cooper has a lot of credibility with the people in North Carolina, and I think that's going to be a very tight race. I think that's going to be one to watch very closely.
So I think the president's masterstroke was the blockade. Mm-hmm. And I think by him, two things. When he sent that ship through the strait on Saturday, Sunday, in the middle of the talks, when everyone was like, wow, Iran has Trump carded us, he took the Strait of Hormuz, we sent the minesweeper and didn't pick two of them. And then we blockade with 15 ships, and now it's complete. Now we've turned around boat ship after ship. I just think it's a total change. Here's Mike Walsh talking about the leverage. Cut 7.
What President Trump has done is taken that leverage, taken Iran trying to hold the entire world's economies hostage, has taken that off the table now with this action. I mean, we cannot, I can tell you from the United Nations standpoint, live in a world where two parties have a conflict, regardless of whether you agree with the conflict or not, and you have, I don't know, a country trying to shut down the Strait of Gibraltar or the Bering Strait or any other international waterway as leverage in a conflict. We've taken that off the table, and that isolates the whole issue to what President Trump has been consistent on since the 1980s, even since before he was in politics. We cannot have a genocidal regime with its finger on a nuclear button, period.
And he's taken action on that now significantly with Soleimani with Midnight Hammer, and now this. So your thoughts of where we're at right now? President speaking optimistically today.
Yeah, you know, I think that's his way. You know, I think he always wants to keep thinking about the diplomatic prescription for what could happen. He's been wanting to do what's happening now in the Gulf, I think, since the beginning of this exchange. I remember I did a phone interview with him several weeks ago, and he wanted a presence in the waterway. To me, this is an indisputable issue, right? Anyone who believes in the free passage of transit and cargo and economies around the world, as Mike Waltz was just saying, should be able to support this, right? No matter how you feel about anything else related to the war, I cannot understand how France and England can look themselves in the eye, because that's what he wanted. He wanted presence and numbers of ships in the Strait to prove, and in the Gulf of Oman, to prove that whatever else is going on, you cannot use this area. You know, Iran has one side of the Strait, right? This Strait does not exist inside the country of Iran. There's like 12 other countries that go around the Horn of the Persian Gulf and then through the Strait of Hormuz out into Oman. So protecting that waterway, I think, is something that many countries should be on the side of. And I think it's laughable that now you've got the UK and France saying, oh, after the war's over, we want to put together a group to preserve this waterway as an international causeway, and we don't want the U.S. to be part of it. We're going to do it on our own with other countries. Hello?
Yeah.
I mean, what are they thinking?
I don't know. If they came up with their 40-nation summit.
Yeah.
Well, number one,
aggressors. So basically, it's like the suggestion is they don't want the United States to be part of it. Good luck. They don't have any ships, first of all.
Yeah, no, they don't have any ships. England has to buy one from Germany. We talked about that last week in order to send a ship down. They don't even send their minesweepers down. So they have,
and they have a few.
Right.
We're low on minesweepers. Yes. They have a few. We could really use them.
Absolutely. And it takes forever for them to go because they move so slow. So if they were on their way 2 weeks ago, certainly would have been helpful. But if they're not shooting, you don't need any escorts. So what are you providing escorts for? So if it's not dangerous, the only way we're moving out is if it's not dangerous. If it's not dangerous, you don't need to be in there. So you're just wasting your time anyway. So, either the Strait's going to be open or not going to be open. If you don't want to be part of the shooting, you shouldn't be there. So NATO evidently is beginning to meet on what NATO would look like without the U.S. That's going to be exciting, isn't it? So they're beginning to try to imagine NATO without our presence or the diminished presence. Do you think that's a smart move on their part?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think they better start figuring out what it looks like. I think they've already sort of opened that door as they talked about increasing their expenditures of their GDP from 2 to 5%. Some of them have done it. Some of them haven't. How much do they care about security? I don't know, because I think you know, where you put your money and your effort as a country shows what your priorities are. And for the past decade and a half, at least, they've put their money and their priority into green energy and really open borders and changing completely the complexion. I mean, that, you know, sort of a melting pot way of their communities and their population. And they've allowed that to change the priorities of the country on foreign policy as well. So I think they better figure out what it looks like without them, because we see a strengthening relationship between the United States and the Gulf states and Israel and Saudi Arabia. And world history shifts over time. It's been 50 years plus since these agreements were made after World War II. But the world shifts. It happens all throughout the course of history. You know that better than anybody. And I think it's shifting right now.
I don't think there's any doubt about it. They're shifting right now. And immediately you say, well, President Trump could have tipped them off and let them know. Well, you had a shot at the Ayatollah, you took it. And even if you would, let's say I'll make that case. Okay, you're right. But did you notice the buildup? Do you don't think they pick up the phone and you don't think President Trump's accessible?
Yeah.
Hey, guys, pretty serious. All I'm going to tell you is, because I don't know who's listening. You know, you don't know what Macron's going to say. You don't know if Macron's going to pick up the phone and call Lebanon or
100%.
Whatever. So, but you guys, you notice what we're doing. I don't do it. It's expensive. Don't usually do it for no reason. That's it. And then when it happens, you could be bent out of shape, and then just have the meeting. Have the meeting. This is what we need. This is what we're doing. This is what we don't know. This is what we're going to. Instead, they're all ticked off. They're outraged. Unnecessary war. When if you look in the past, if anybody's responsible for the mess that is Iran, it's France. They took Ayatollah Khomeini in. They allowed him to live and hold.
They brought him in on a plane and walked him down the staircase.
Yes. And then they put him on an Air France jet and they put him back in Iran. And now it's the world's problem. And you're mad at us for cracking down on the world's problem.
Yeah.
Well, who they just wiped out 41,000 people.
You know, just going a couple of quick things. Just going back to that morning, right? Because the intelligence indicated that they were all at a breakfast, the leadership of the IRGC and the Ayatollah and his group. Does anyone think that they would have stayed in that building for 30 seconds longer if anyone had tipped them off? And so obviously intelligence and the timing of it had to do with that, with this clear signal that you have all of these people in this building right now. You can't tip off other countries for this. And as you point out, the larger picture was set. The table was set. The military presence was in the region in a huge way, just like it had been off Venezuela. They can read the tea leaves. I think it's like, it's ridiculous for these countries in Europe to say, oh, well, you didn't really tell us what you were going to do. I just think it's preposterous.
Right.
And they need to grow up.
So one thing, it's not unusual for people to be critical of Donald Trump on the left, but the incessant way they've done it is so over the top. For example, when you have Jason Crow, who served in the military, special forces guy, when you have people like Senator Mark Kelly, I noticed when CNN and MS now, I don't know how much you watch, but when they get the military people on, who have dealt with Iran, unless they're really politically driven, they have a hard time being critical of the operation and the need for
Absolutely.
The mission.
Absolutely.
And I know, believe me, they're trying. They're trying to get them to throw Trump under the bus. And when he does a tweet or something, he'll jump on that. But then when the Democrats come out, right away, knee-jerk reaction, everything he does is wrong. Listen to Chuck Schumer and compare this to Iraq or Afghanistan. Cut 14.
Starting this week, we will bring a war powers resolution to the floor, and if Republicans block it, we will vote again and again and again. Until this war ends, or Congress does its job and holds the administration accountable, we will bring these resolutions to the floor every week. I believe 10 of them have been filed. Okay, why do we do this? Because our troops deserve a mission, not a mess.
And he says epic fury should be named epic failure. So when the Iranians see that, they go, oh, America's coming apart. I mean, Trump's acting different, acting like it doesn't matter, but that's what they want. So I'm just stunned by it. I think it's thoroughly irresponsible. This guy's desperate to hold on to his job, but you could be critical. But to say epic mess in the middle of a war, are you kidding?
It's not at all surprising because absolutely everything that the president does, they're against. I always wonder, you know, if you put another person in that, in these actions, if Barack Obama had decided, you know what, it's time, of course you'd be hearing something completely different from them. But I'm also trying to figure out what it is. So he wants the war to end, he said. So I guess he wants to create an environment where the mullahs and the new Ayatollah can thrive. Is that the goal?
What he wants.
So after 47 years of killing Americans, acts of terrorism, supporting terrorist proxies all over the world, essentially, Chuck Schumer saying he wants it to stop so that they can stay in control, apparently. Now, I know we're saying regime change is not the goal. I have a issue with that, really, because I don't see how any of this dynamic changes if this leadership stays in place. So either you have to, like Israel keeps saying, create the environment where it falls.
Right.
But one way or the other, nothing's ultimately going to change until that happens.
Well, by the way, the JCPOA, now everyone's saying Barack Obama had it right. Look at how great it was. We watched Blinken and Sullivan and Kerry come out and hail it. They don't remember what a disaster it was, allowed enrichment. And guess who else thought it was a disaster? The year is 2015. You'll recognize the voice.
Under this agreement, Iran would receive at least $50 billion in the future and would undoubtedly use some of that money to create even more trouble in the Middle East and perhaps beyond. Current autocratic regime views this deal as a way to get relief from onerous sanctions while still retaining their designs on nuclear arms and regional hegemony. To me, the very real risk that Iran will not moderate and will instead use the agreement to pursue its nefarious goals is too great. Therefore, I will vote to disapprove the agreement.
Right. So, and then if the pallets of cash arrive, and what does Saudi Arabia say? They use the pallets of cash to buy missiles, not anything for their people. That is Chuck Schumer 2015.
Yeah, and if you ask the Iranian leadership why their people have suffered so much Given the fact that they've had this influx of money, they just always blame the sanctions. Well, we just can't do anything to fix our economy. We have a 97% inflation rate. We have a currency that's completely devalued. It's worth absolutely nothing mm-hmm. on the world stage. And what do they have to show for it? Except what we're learning is a lot of missiles that they buried in the ground, like Iwo Jima. And that's what they're surviving on right now. But Chuck Schumer, you know, you have to have a through line as a human being. You have to have a moral compass that doesn't allow you to make this kind of tremendous swing in the way that you look at things. I find it very difficult to believe, but it's like he just has an on-off switch, you know? If it's anything that Trump is doing, then it must be horrible, even if he thought it was a great idea a few years ago.
A few more minutes with Martha McCallum, exclusive interview about what she's going to be talking about at 3 o'clock besides Senator John Thune. She'll give up more in a moment.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So Martha McCallum, at 3 o'clock today, you're going to have Senator John Thune. That's enough. But is there anything else?
We're also going to talk to Mike Pompeo, who I want to dig in, obviously, as former Secretary of State, but also in terms of his CIA role, because one of the things that does concern me, I can imagine at the CIA right now, they're looking at the possibility of asymmetric warfare from Iran, because what Iran has always been good at is terrorism. If they feel boxed in by these sort of conventional warfare that has been going on in terms of taking out military yeah. sites, blockading, all of this, my gut tells me that we need to be very concerned about cyber warfare, potentially biological warfare. And also I want to talk to him about the link of China. China is a huge part of this story of what's playing out in Iran. And so we'll talk to Mike Pompeo about that.
All right, so you have a book coming out in November, right?
Mm-hmm, I do.
I'm going to hit you with some dates, and you tell me where you want to join. Well, first off, March 30th, I'm in Reno, Nevada with History, Liberty, and Laughs. And then July 11th, Pensacola, Florida. I'm going to start weaving in the new show for Uniting the States, my new book that comes out October 16th. So I'm going to throw out these dates. You tell me. Red Bank, New Jersey. Count Basie Center, have you been there?
Yes.
October 16th. The 17th in Westbury, New York. You've already committed to me.
I like both of these, actually.
Okay, great. Clearwater, Florida, November 7th. Your book will be out when?
So my book is planning to come out the week of November 9th.
And what's the name of it?
And these books are such great companion pieces in so many ways. We touch on some of the things that you're totally focused on. My book is called The Book of Valor, and it's American tales of survival and gallantry and grace. And it goes all the way from the Mayflower women who basically pulled it together to help get people through that first winter because everybody was dying after they got off the ship. They all made it across and fine. And most of them died that first winter, all the way through the war in Afghanistan. So, and it's told in the narrative voices of 12 different individuals who tell the story of America through the era that they lived in.
Well, what date is that going to come out? Do you know yet?
We're looking at 4th? November 9th.
November 9th.
November 9th.
All right, so Clearwater, Florida. You'll have enough. You could do that one.
Absolutely.
Jacksonville, Florida, November 8th. And then Chesterfield, Missouri, which is right outside St. Louis at the factory where Jimmy Fallon was just. So go to BrianKilmeade.com for details, but we're also going to try to weave Martha in through
that.
That
would be super
that.
Fun. I'd love to join you.
All right, so quick prediction. When's this war end?
That's a tough one. I think it's going to be a little while. I'm going to give it another few months.